This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, welcome everyone. We'll go ahead and call this February 8th meeting to order for the University Assembly. I'll start here with our roll call and turn that over to Casey to do the roll call.
Awesome. Ian Akishola?
Here.
Valerie Amer?
Present.
Marcy Benda?
Present.
Richard Bensel?
Yes.
Duncan Katie?
Here.
Nicola Danek? Eve DeRosa?
Excuse.
Jacob Fite?
Here.
Brandon Thornberry?
Here.
Thomas Fox?
Here.
Preston Hanley?
Here.
David Heiner?
He's here.
Deborah Howell? Present.
Sorry.
I'm here.
Caroline Levine? Vinaya Lewis? Annalie Anonia?
Excuse.
James Richards? Damien Sharp?
Here.
Jessica Withers?
Here.
All right, thank you very much. Now we'll move to our land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayakono, the Cuga Nation. The Gayakono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayakono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayakono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. With that, we'll move to a call for late additions to the agenda. I would ask if perhaps one of the exec committee could add just a note about the president's visit. We could add that to the agenda to speak to the survey coming up.
Yep. It's on there,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right, we're good to go then. All right, we will move now into approval of the minutes. We have the January 25th meeting minutes attached to the meeting. I would entertain a motion for any adjustment or approval of the minutes.
Move.
Just comment.
Approve.
Motion to approve. Do you have a second?
Second.
Seconded by Preston. Thank you. Any, this will be unanimous consent. If there's no objections, meeting minutes are approved. All right. With that, then, we will move in to welcome our visitors here this evening that are here to present from the Public Safety Advisory Committee. I'd like to welcome Joanne DiStefano, the Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, as well as our VP for Student and Campus Life, Brian Lombardi, and Melanie Ciattoli, I see, has joined us as well, Chief of Staff, and in Student and Campus Life has joined us as well. So I'll turn it over to Joanne and Ryan, and you should have the ability to share your screen if you have presentation.
Thank you very much, Brandon. Ryan and I, while I'm trying to train, can you see it?
No.
No. Okay. Hang on.
Let's try that again.
So we're not teaching online anymore.
Let's hope we don't go back.
Huh?
Let's hope we don't go back.
You bet.
Can you see this?
Not seeing anything on the screen.
Oh, wonderful.
If you want to just, if you'd like to email us.
Oh, here we go. I have it. Now I have it.
Now.
Yes.
That's better. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay. So thank you, everyone. Ryan and I would like to spend most of our time today feedback and advice. But before doing so, I'm going to briefly provide some background on the work of our PSAC committee, remind everyone of the recommendations that we made last year, and update you on our current activities. PSAC as a committee has been around for a long time. It's a required committee by New York State and has some very prescriptive components, particularly on committee composition. And our current committee is listed on the screen, as you can see. We do have one staff member opening, so if anyone has any recommendations or any interest in the committee, please let us know. Membership is nominated by the various governance groups. So the Student Assembly nominates the student members of the committee, and the Faculty Senate nominates the Faculty Senate. And then we're allowed to comprise one third of the membership through an institutional. I'd like to just highlight one person on this list, and it's down at the bottom. It's Connor Hodges, and some of you may know him. He was a PSAC member. He graduated from Cornell in December, and he's currently enrolled this spring semester at John Jay College. He's working on his master's degree in the inspection and oversight program of the criminal justice program. He's also applying for PhD programs for next year. Connor is very passionate about public safety reform, and he's agreed to continue to work with us as our racial justice and public safety fellow while he's working on his master's program. Just a reminder, President Pollack, back in last summer of 2020, when she published her racial justice initiatives, she tasked the existing Public Safety Advisory Committee to reimagine public safety and security, and asked me at that time to take over as chair of the committee. The first year since we were tasked with looking at public safety, we had three major forms of campus outreach. We had a campus survey, we conducted focus groups, and a campus forum. We published the results of each of our activities, but I just want to remind everyone what some of the key findings were. On the satisfaction with Cornell Police, there was overall on all participants a 7% dissatisfaction. However, when we broke down the data, Black students were nearly three times as likely to express dissatisfaction. 38% of all respondents said they were uneasy in the presence of off-campus armed police. 69% of our Black students said they were uneasy in the presence of off-campus armed police. 30% of the respondents said they were uneasy around the presence of armed Cornell police, and 58% of our Black students said they were uneasy. Many people told us they felt safe and appreciative of Cornell police, of their presence and their ability to respond, and was highly valued. However, Cornell police was also perceived as much more aggressive towards students of color or other underrepresented minorities. There were, in all cases, concerns about armed officers responding to mental health issues. The committee took the feedback from the various community outreaches and wrote a report and submitted it to President Pollack in July of 2021, so this past summer. There were four key recommendations. One was to have an institutional public statement about our commitment to enacting anti-racist public safety. Another one is to develop an alternative public safety and response model. And then following that, having an education campaign. And then finally, diversifying the public safety workforce more than it is. So that ended the first year of the Public Safety Advisory Committee. And what I'm going to share now hasn't shared much. So this is an update on our current year activities. President Pollack did respond to our July report in August, and she in general supported all of the recommendations of the report. Ryan joined me as co-chair of PSAC, mainly due to the overlap of some of his public safety responsibilities, in particular the new Cornell response team that is within Ryan's oversight. We've met several times this current academic year. We've brought in guests to help us in thinking through alternative response models. And then we formed a small, very small subcommittee with one of our faculty members, a couple of the people from the police organization who run the 9/11 call center, and Connor Hodges. The subcommittee to date has made three recommendations, and one of them is they've been reviewing all of the higher ed and other municipal alternative response activities, and they're looking for best practices. And then with that data, they're very meticulously going through the Cornell University call logs to see if there's any other campus organizations who could better handle certain calls. The Cornell response team is an example of where they're the first responders now for some of our mental health activities. So further recommendations are going to be made. This is a very methodical process that they're going through right now. Per the second recommendation, we just recently added Sam Kaplan to our PSAC committee. He's the student director for the Cornell University Emergency Management System. And finally, we're going to be looking for ways to make further recommendations on our alternative response models. I want to close on this update by saying that the PSAC group has been very thoughtful throughout the entire process for the past 2 years. They've also developed relationships with our Cornell police, and I truly believe that everyone understands each other's concerns much better. I also want to thank Dave Honan, our chief of police, for being an active participant in some of these very difficult conversations and his willingness to want to improve things for the safety of our students, faculty, and staff. With that, I just want to ask Ryan if there's anything else that he wants to add before we open up for questions or comments.
Thanks, Joanne. No, you covered it well as you all gather. I'm new to this committee, but I'm glad to be here and help answer any questions that I can.
So that was a very quick overview of our last 2 years' work, and we're happy, as Ryan said, we're both happy to answer any questions or receive any feedback that anyone wants to give us.
Thank you very much, Joanne and Ryan. With that, I'll open the floor if there are any questions. I have some available here, but I welcome others have questions or comments. If you're ready, I'll recognize Duncan.
Hi, Ryan. Nice to see you again. I ran into you the other day when we were going to class, so it's good to see you in print or on, you know what I mean. And Joanne, I don't think we've met, but it's nice to meet you, and thank you for coming out. I had two quick questions. First, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this subcommittee, what you really expect to see its progress look like, and I'm wondering if you could run through the members one more time for me.
Okay. So first question, the subcommittee. We actually, when we issued our July report, one of the recommendations was to actually bring in a third party to come help us review and make recommendations for an alternative response. And we sent out some RFPs. We received a couple. The price was incredibly expensive. It was about $500,000, and we didn't think we were going to get sufficient value from that. So what we ended up doing was taking what we learned was the process from these outside consultants that are actually trying to work through the process ourselves, So what we're trying to do is understand all of the emergency calls that go through the Cornell Police 911, 911 center, and then who responds currently. And then we're looking at national trends to see who has other responders other than armed police for the various activities, and what where the group is to date is they've identified about five or six entities that have alternate responses, and they've looked at what those responses are, and now they're matching it back to our current, our Cornell's 9/11 log to see if we can come up with some recommendations here. Our goal is to have all of our recommendations for a fully planned out alternative response model by the end of the academic year, so within the next couple of months.
That's great. And just to answer the second part there, what the current membership looks like for that subcommittee, I see that's for PSAC. Is this the same membership within the subcommittee? Because I think you mentioned a couple specific people.
Yes. So, thank you.
Yeah, I'm doing that, Joanne. So
thank you. I was wondering. Thank you, Ryan. So Connor Hodges is leading the subcommittee. And again, he's been the what I'll call the researcher. And we have Peggy Matta. Yeah, if you could just stay right on that page.
Sorry. Yeah.
Thank you. Peggy Matta from Cornell Police Compliance. Mark Conrad, who runs the 9/11 call center, and then Sahara Byrne, who's our one of our faculty representatives.
Awesome.
On the subcommittee.
Awesome. Yeah, I was just asking, I've worked with Connor. He's fantastic. I'm also in the student assembly where he's come to speak with us many times. I'm curious if there's any interest or what's the logic behind not involving undergraduate students. I understand this is like obviously a high abstraction issue, and I think it's great that there's many representatives from the Cornell community. But why specifically undergrad students have been included in this subcommittee, at least so far?
Yeah. So to be honest with you, the difficulty has been finding anyone willing to put in the time. Connor was an undergraduate student and was part of the subcommittee, and because we didn't have anyone stepping up, we've made him a fellow so that he could continue the work. My understanding is that the SA passed a resolution this past week to create and I might have the name wrong, a health and safety committee.
Yeah, the public health and safety committee.
Public health and safety committee. And Connor and Joseph Mullen were two co-sponsors of that.
You're speaking to one right now as well. Yes.
Okay, great.
That's why I'm asking about this. So.
Yeah. So my understanding is, and this my information is directly from Connor. So correct me if I misstate this. My understanding is because we've had such a difficult time getting undergraduates to actively participate, they're hoping to use this committee as a way of seeking input. We do want undergraduate feedback and support and participation. So if you yourself are interested, please let me know.
Yeah, I would have to learn more about that, but I'm just curious from the perspective of the student assembly really would love, I think, to open the door for more undergraduate involvement. And I think this new subcommittee for the student assembly or this new committee for the student assembly would love to work with that subcommittee.
Yes.
So, but that's a future conversation. So thank you.
That's our goal too. So thank you.
Thank you, Duncan. Any other questions or comments from the group? It's Tom.
Hello, my name is Tom Fox. I'm a faculty representative. I'm just curious whether the unarmed CRT has actually been active to date and what the experience may have been.
You want me to take that, Joanne?
That's yours, Ryan.
Sure thing. Tom, I appreciate the question. The community response team has been active. We have had we have a total of four positions that we have for that. Three of them are filled right now, and they've been working actively since last year and responding to right now only Cornell residential facilities, so they're not going to off-campus spaces at all, but they are responding to Cornell residential facilities for things that don't require law enforcement. And it's been a learning process, and that's part of what the subcommittee is also looking at, as CRT has, it got off the ground even before all these recommendations were finalized, after the initial desire by the president to create this alternative response model. So now that we're getting, PSAC is kind of catching up to CRT, we're also doing a review as we go along to make sure our early experience with CRT is that it's being effective, that students are receiving it well, that it's integrating well with the other responders like CU EMS, and in the occasion where the CRT needs to call in CUPD, that's happening fluidly and that handoff is smooth for the community members. So we're working through some of the growing pains, but they are operating and active for sure. They also have a physical presence on North Campus in the Appel Commons building. So they are there overnight physically as well, so they can, you know, respond immediately to incidents that happen, since there's a density of residences up on North Campus.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll do a follow-up there. Question on that, Ryan. And so with the upcoming NCRE finalizing and opening up the rest of those residential halls, is there an expectation or an anticipation of increasing the volume of CRTs that are available, especially on that North Campus space, just with the number of students that will be living there? As you can imagine, likelihood of incidents could go up.
Yeah, Brandon, it's a great question. That has been one of, as we've been reviewing this, our early experience, that is one of the emerging themes, is that we will likely need to grow our resource investment in alternative response like the CRT. And so we haven't put a finer point on that just yet in terms of what that will look like. But I do anticipate that likely being an outcome. I will say these are not the easiest positions to recruit and retain. You know, they're overnight jobs, and they're not always for the faint of heart. I mean, it's intense, emotionally intensive work. And during COVID, it's been particularly difficult to recruit staff, as you all have probably experienced in your own units.
Thank you, Ryan. Jacob has a question.
Yeah, well, very informative, as I expected it would be. We all appreciate, I'm sure, the work that you all are doing in trying to make our campus a lot safer than it is. I'm curious, moving forward, what are some of the immediate concerns that you all have in terms of making our campus safer? What are the most immediate obstacles that the Public Safety Advisory Committee has to overcome in order to reach those goals? And off of that, given the data and the research that you all have gathered, you know, I don't know if, you know, Connor's not here, but what seems to be some of the biggest issues in a practical sense for both the officers and for this alternative response team in actually making sure that they can carry out their responsibilities while also keeping our community safe?
So I'll start and then I'll let Ryan finish. So one of the practical issues that we're going to have to deal with is, you know, the police are currently covering campus 24/7 now. And whether intended or not, because they've been available, they've been called for lots of things. As we start to identify alternative responses, it's likely that we don't have those services during the hours that they're needed. As Ryan mentioned, the CRTs are overnight. So everything's going to be an incremental budget. And how do we do that? You know, we could cut the police budget to cover it, but we also have to keep the campus safe. And so it's going to be a very delicate balancing act. I think in the end, you know, we may have fewer police officers depending on how many alternative responses we identify. But in the end, we will have a higher budget. What worries me isn't so much our campus safety, it's the surrounding area safety. You know, there's been an uptick in more violent crimes, gun crimes, in the Ithaca surrounding area. And our police only have jurisdiction on our campus. And, you know, we've read a lot about what's going on with the Ithaca police and their budget cuts and things like that. So that does worry me, because College Town is predominantly covered by Ithaca Police, not Cornell Police.
The only thing I would add as a general observation, when you think about safety, and when I think many students think about safety, they only actually think about it if it's a problem, or if there's a threat to their safety, or if they're feeling unsafe or something like that. It's not necessarily something that's top of mind, and that can be even more amplified in a community like this that's generally fairly safe. You know, a rural community, you're not interacting on a regular basis with crime of significant volumes like you might in a more urban setting. And so it's just making sure that safety remains top of mind for our community members. I think it speaks to the point earlier that Duncan and Joanne were having the conversation about engagement from students, not in a moment of crisis, but rather on an ongoing basis, so that we can build these partnerships with law enforcement, with alternative response, and with our student body to make sure that we're serving the campus well.
One of the recommendations that just came out of the PSAT committee, we had the Cornell Police Crime Prevention Unit attend our meeting last Friday, and the student representatives on the committee talked about one of their biggest fears that Ryan was just talking about, their personal safety. And so that is something that we're going to work on right away, is develop more of a program within our education crime prevention division on how they can provide more personal safety guidance for our students.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Kind of on that same question there around engagement, as we saw in the last semester during the public forums, the engagement around this conversation was very high as we were beginning to develop many plans and looking to address many of the concerns. And then as the plan began to roll out, the engagement from my perspective was very limited. I wonder, what are the plans to help to amplify that engagement? What are some of the communication strategies that you're looking at? We heard from that forum around folks asking, you know, how are we going to inform students about what's out there, what number to call, who to call? What are some of the strategies that are in the works or being talked about around amplifying the engagement from students before it becomes an issue?
So that is one of our recommendations of our initial report, is to figure out how to improve the engagement. And, you know, we were feeling, like you, Brandon, that there's fewer people willing to engage. So any recommendations that any of you all have, we don't have that piece figured out at all. We're happy to take any feedback you have on that.
Thank you, John. David?
Yeah, off of that point really quickly, I'm just curious as to where this information is made, if it is publicly available to students, to community members, because I think that transparency, especially in the regard of public safety on campus, is really paramount.
Yeah, so all of our meeting minutes, all of our reports, if you on a Cornell site just type in PSAC, P-S-A-C, it should come up. It's under the Cornell Police. One of our New York State requirements is to have the information publicly available. So we have our survey results, our final report issued in July, and all of our meeting minutes from the last 2 years. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you. And I have one last question, and if anyone else has one. I want to make sure I understand. The RFP went out. That was around doing the assessment, understanding how we utilize alternative response mechanisms and looking at what we do. And you stated that the RFP went out, but unfortunately we were not able to hire any of those companies. Is that correct?
Yeah, the RFP went out. We actually had to send it out twice because there was also lack of interest from consultants in doing this work. And what we asked for was the research data on other entities that may be best practices, and then to help us develop our plan utilizing our data also. We did end up with two responses and considered parsing out one. For those of you who know Connor, he's just really a special person. Ryan knows where I'm going.
He's brilliant. He's brilliant.
Yeah, he's brilliant. The subcommittee was interviewing the firms, and Connor had put together the fact that the language they were using in our proposal was exactly verbatim what they had used on another client. And he called them out in their meeting. So we really reevaluated and just felt that we could do the work ourselves. And Connor's connected to at least half a dozen entities that he's on biweekly calls with them. Oregon State is one, not Oregon the state, not Oregon State. Johns Hopkins is a university. They're looking at some stuff and a few others. So we're doing the work ourselves right now.
Any other questions or comments from the agenda? Well, I want to just echo what you said there, Joanne, about asking to the assembly here for engagement, asking folks to reach out and be engaged with your constituencies around what can we do to support this initiative. As I mentioned, there's a lot of conversation around it, a lot of action that happened for a period of time, and I would hate to see that focus be lost when it is such an important topic for our community, both here on campus and outside. So we encourage everyone to consider, I'm glad to hear, Duncan, that there has been a committee in the student assembly to look to the rest of the conversation. Very nice.
Jump the gun with that, yeah. I was excited to tell all of you, but.
Get the news early.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Joanne and Ryan, for joining us this evening. I really appreciate that, for taking time to give us these updates.
Thank you all. Have a nice evening.
Bye.
Take care. All right, everyone. So now we'll move on to the constituent report, which we've already heard a little bit on them. So we'll move over to we'll start the report and we'll move forward. So I'll turn it over. Annalie was not able to join us this evening, so that will be our student assembly report.
I love it. I think it's super exciting. I like giving these. So student assembly met twice, as we tend to do every 2 weeks. We met January 27th and February 3rd. Between those two meetings, we passed three resolutions. We saw four. I'm going to go through them in the order that they were numbered, and I can ask any questions if you have them about it, but you kind of got a hint at them. The first resolution, Resolution 38, establishes the Public Health and Safety Committee. That was the one that was just referenced there. I can speak to a little bit as a co-signer, but really just what it does is it's a new committee designed at kind of absorbing more student involvement in issues of public safety and public health. There currently already is a lot of student interest in it, and as well as there's obviously PSAC. I know I'm talking with the food's coming in, it's distracting. I'll keep it short. But the whole point of this committee, above many other things, is really to promote safety, promote public health through student involvement, student engagement, recognizing that we are in a diverse campus and the small number of students that currently represent student interests can be expanded into broader perspectives. Really, it's an exciting opportunity, so if you have any interested undergrads, you can let them know. That one was passed unanimously. Then it was Resolution 39, Zoom Live Transcript Implementation Request. If any of you are in, I believe, Cal's Arts and a couple of other schools have already put up emails about this, but essentially, as you can kind of see in the Zoom call right there, there's the like live transcript, the like closed caption. There's a lot of names for it. That was a feature that was added to Zoom in, I think it was introduced in the beta version in early October, but now it's like fully integrated into all Zoom and it's available on every Zoom call Cornell has access to. So even if it's just a personal meeting or if it's a big seminar with hundreds of people, Cornell has that feature. So this request put up by myself and Representative Kate Santa Cruz just ask that it's turned on when available. The concept is that it's really easy, but it has to be requested and then approved by the meeting host. So say your meeting host, who might not be too attuned to technology, you might not know that that's available. It's actually only one click, that live transcript button to the host. So it's just kind of trying to ask teams, inform faculty, staff, et cetera, about the importance and the opportunity with this for people with disabilities, people with focus issues, really all sorts of things. Then lastly, we also passed Resolution 40, the Spring Festival Special Funding Project. So obviously the Student Assembly has special funding projects. So exciting. How many university assembly members did it take to open up some food? Is a real question.
One night.
I know, I'm enjoying it though. It's good. I promise I'm almost done. This basically was an allocation of the Student Assembly's Special Activities Fund, of which we have like a certain set of money set aside for. This was to fund what is a participation of, I'm forgetting the exact number, but a large number of student groups trying to celebrate Lunar New Year through the Spring Festival Gala, is what it's called. So the Student Assembly took the money to fund towards that, as well as develop some other funding sources, which is part of sponsoring that event. That's really exciting. It's open to all Cornell community members. I don't have the date in front of me, but obviously you're more than welcome to come. Besides that, there was nominations to the Office of Ethics, as well as resignation of the Director of Elections, Patrick Mailer, who some of you may know is now the new alder person, or one of the new alder people, for the Common Council, being stepped away from the position of elections. I was just feeling like I should note this. His like CV for this is incredible, including a 33% increase in voter turnout among Cornellians. So really his involvement in that is spectacular, and he will surely be missed. But hopefully next meeting I'll be able to announce a new election for that. So I see any questions that you have.
Any questions for me? I do have one as far as the Public Health and Safety Committee. So is that something that could be made available to others who need to attend that meeting, especially if
you're... Yeah, it is in very early infancy stages. It was just passed like Thursday.
Okay.
So we're far from appointing any commissions. But yeah, the whole concept of it is really is just to open the door to like broader community involvement that can be brought to PSAC. It was born out of a lot of conversations about undergrad students wanting to get more involved, and obviously a lot of undergraduate students concerned about how these things are handled from their perspective, as one of the largest constituencies in the CUPD environment, in the environment of public safety environment, of just public health in general. So it was really trying to open doors for those kind of conversations and encourage student involvement and student perspectives.
I think that's a great addition. As I helped moderate the conversation around the PSAC this last semester, and extremely limited attendance. And I know that there are people who have strong feelings about this, who are concerned about the health and safety of the community here. So really happy to hear that, and definitely want to be available to help out. So please keep us in the loop.
Definitely. I'll be excited to report back as had a discussion.
Any other questions for Duncan? All right. And the live transcript is also great. It's a great feature that makes that available, more accessible for folks on meetings. I've been trying to be more cognizant of it. I do a lot of like large presentations, and I always try to remember to set my meeting to do that in advance. And so I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's great to see you. It's good to hear.
All right, next up we'll move to the GPSA. And if folks want to grab a beverage, that's going to be great as well. Yeah, why don't we take just a quick minute and let everyone get some food so that you don't get interrupted during your presentation. For those of you just joining us, the food arrived, and we haven't had assembly food in a long time, so it's a bit crazy in here. So we took a brief pause to get some food, and I think we've all settled in now, and we can move right back into our agenda. We're on the GPSA, so
This is the incentive to come in person.
Yeah, today we just did light snacks. Next week we'll have a little bit extra food.
Don't really eat react.
Okay, so we had a meeting last Monday, our first meeting of the semester. Don't really have anything to report. We had some housekeeping things. Our appropriations chair and the finance committee chair. Their terms run the calendar year, so we had to elect two new positions there. And next week, I'm not sure what we're going to be getting into next week either. So I'm excited for the semester for sure.
Thank you. Any questions for Preston? All right. We'll move to the employee assembly.
So we had a meeting last week that included a presentation from the current employee elected trustee, Reginald White. He talked about the role of the employee elected trustee and the board of trustees. And it actually turned into perfect timing because Reginald was leaving Cornell at the end of February for a job at another college. So that position will be open, it will be vacant. So hopefully we drummed up some interest in the position, so that when there's an election, we'll have some people running for it. Other news, we have scheduled an employee assembly hosted staff forum, COVID in the new semester. That will be on Friday, February 18th at noon with senior leadership to talk about the new semester. Obviously, to talk about the new semester and COVID. I'm sorry. So that forum is coming up, and I think there will be a call for pre-submitted questions, right? Yep. So that will be announced, and I think it's on the events page already. Yep. So those are our two main items.
Thank you, Jessica. Any questions for Jessica? And I see Eve has joined us now, and we'll turn it over to Eve for an update from the Faculty Senate.
Hi, everyone. Sorry I was late today. We had a longer dentist appointment than we wanted for our but for our first meeting of the semester, we have our education committees commenting on a proposal from the provost's office for the part-time bachelor's degree for non-traditional students. And we're getting a couple of updates in terms of grants administration and IRB. And then we have two proposals that are being presented. One is a resolution, and it's the pool resolution that's going through all the assemblies. And then we have a conversation that's starting with Vice President Ryan Lombardi from Student and Campus Life on whether we get rid of the SWIM test requirement. And yeah, so it's been suspended for the since COVID. And so just asking the question of whether it's something that should we come back based on data that they received from the athletics department. And so it's a conversation that we're getting started and we'll see where it goes. That's it.
Go ahead, Jacob.
Thank you very much, Eve. I reviewed the proposal that you had discussed last week regarding the honors conferral, the multiple amendments made there. And I'll save those questions for another time when we talk about that. But overall, actually, I was very supportive of it, except for the dean's list part. But you can read my statement and what have you, and I'd love to talk offline regarding that. My question is specifically in regards to the part-time bachelor program. What is the precedent for that? I believe Harvard has it, but what other schools have it, and to what degree is it, do you believe, will it be implemented successfully here or not?
So the other examples, Brown has a similar program, Columbia has a similar program, Harvard, of course. So there's a UPenn. A lot of those are in urban settings, and so that's why Cornell had never really considered this. But once we realized that we could successfully educate students using remote, then can we use virtual learning and some part of on-campus experience to reach students that we haven't traditionally been able to reach? This is not anywhere close to a done deal. The committee's reports that are coming are saying they like the idea, but these are all the problems or issues we see that need to be resolved before even thinking about this. So it really is at the germination stage. It's not a proposal, a concrete proposal yet. And then I should let you know that we're still taking feedback on the honors and distinctions. So if anybody wants to give feedback to me or to directly to the office of the Vice Provost of Education, this is also still not, this hasn't gone to a vote. It's still being revised and taking feedback from people. So you should know that as well. So if you want to send some feedback and send it in.
Awesome. And I also noticed when I was on the Faculty Senate's site, that there's also plans for some sort of program with the New York State Correctional Department for offering classes in our federal, state prisons to reduce recidivism. Where is that?
We already do that.
That's so, done.
You can do it every year.
For decades.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Never mind.
Take a government class, Jake.
But what they've learned is actually, this is actually a very, in this context, it's what's really cool about this is the best students are the CPAP students because they have time. So they are really great students. And they've only allowed up until this point for them to have an associate's degree. Right. And so based on the feedback that's coming from Senate committees, they're thinking, well, maybe that's our test case.
Right. So, yeah, that's what I was asking.
Yes. So what you're seeing is they're thinking about taking that associate's degree and expanding it to a bachelor's degree as almost a test case.
Okay.
Yes, Duncan.
Hi, Dean DeRosa. Thank you again for the comments. I got to comment on Jake's thing first. The program, the prison thing, is awesome. If any of you don't know about it, look into it. It is so, so cool. And you know, undergrads can get involved in TA in that, and it's a super exciting program. Just great experience with that. So I'm happy to see it's moving forward with updates. I'd like to also comment similarly off what Jake said, because again, going through the report. You know, I think I agree a lot with the first and third recommendation and, you know, the majority of the proposal. I think it's really thought out and sound, and I think it is a good thing for, you know, students and faculty and a lot of people involved in this campus. That said, I do also disagree on the dean's list. And while I have you here again, I'd like to invite you, please, and if any other person in the provost office or anyone else involved in the faculty senate would like to come as well, to come to the student assembly. This is now, I believe, the second time I'm getting fielded with questions from student assembly representatives as well as people in the Daily Sun asking about this specific recommendations around dean's list, along with the report. And again, you know, I'm telling people read the report because I changed my perspective a little bit, reading it a little bit more, to be honest. But I'd love if you and maybe other people involved could come and hear the feedback of the student assembly, because I think we're a large constituent, very affected in this. I think there's a lot of really great voices and perspectives that would love to talk to you about this.
So I'm meeting with the Office of the Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education to give her feedback from more of the faculty members. So at that time, I can ask them if they would like to come to the student assembly.
Yeah.
And also the chairs of our education policy committees.
Yeah, sadly, Anna's not here, so I can't defer to her scheduling wisdom.
We can at least get together and talk about
that. I can say this, though. If there's enough interest from students on members that I think we could move a couple things. So whatever their schedule looks like, we'd love to get anyone involved.
Okay, I will let them know for sure.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Eve, I had a question. As far as the part-time bachelor's program, has anyone working on that process reached out to the education committee on the employee assembly? I think they might be a good voice to speak to some of the benefits that would stem from the employee perspective.
I will 100% share that with the provost.
Right, thank you very much. And I believe it's Marcy, who's the chair of the education committee?
Marcy is the chair, but Jackie is our liaison to the Faculty Senate, and she's also on the Education Committee.
Oh, okay.
So might already have a connection, but I'm sure Marcy would welcome more.
Yes, I would welcome more. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, any other questions for Dean DeRosa? All right, we'll move into committee reports. I'll turn it over to Jacob for the Executive Committee.
We really don't have much to discuss. We had one very brief meeting. I'll just save everyone's time. I mean, I don't know, unless there's anything that you want to talk about that I don't think we've touched on. I think except for the President Pollock is coming. But I think you all should know that by now. And we are accepting questions to give her a little bit of time to compile a detailed and thoughtful response. So if you're interested, we can share the link with you all to submit those questions.
Yeah, we'll send that out after this meeting with the plan to let everybody know that it's coming out and just to advocate for those questions to come in. I know some folks may view that as, well, I would rather hear the real answer than what was prepared, but some of the questions that we're going to ask may require that President Pollock ask other areas that may not be her expertise. And so giving the president that opportunity to bring in the experts in those fields is very important and beneficial. And I think you can see from our last conversation we had, though, that she was able to provide us, and we were able to ask follow-up questions that got us a little bit more of that candid responses that we were looking for. So I encourage you, if you have a topic or a subject, provide that question in advance so that President Pollock is able to come prepared with some information and acknowledge that you may have to ask, you may want to ask follow-ups if you get additional questions from that. So we'll send that survey out after the meeting.
Yeah, sure.
Anything you miss, Richard?
That's it.
And James is not here, so we'll move past the codes and judicial, and we'll go over to Deborah with the campus welfare.
Hi, everyone. The campus welfare committee hasn't met since last time. We actually meet this week. But there is a very drafty version of a resolution that we'll be bringing forward, hopefully for a vote in March. We want it to coincide with the Faculty Senate's vote on their resolution for an auditorium, because ours is being written in support of theirs. And I would actually recommend, after talking to some folks and figuring out how this process works, that if the student assembly or GPSA or employee assembly would also like to write a resolution in support of the Faculty Senate's resolution, the more support from the various assemblies, the better. In the meantime, if you would like to read through this draft and make any comments, please do. Please go ahead and share it with your assemblies. Please don't share it a lot wider, because it really is very drafty. And also, I don't have the updated version of the Faculty Senate's resolution as the appendix. There was one, but I'm waiting for an updated copy to put that in there. And then I also do need to send it out to various stakeholders at the university as well for their comments. So it's a process. We're working on it, and we're targeting a March hopeful vote here.
Thank you very much, Deborah. One second, I just wanted to make a note that I forgot to make as far as the key. We provided key points to the president for her visit that we asked her to kind of speak to. And the four key points that we provided were your resolution reminded me that we asked for wellness facilities and programs, just acknowledging the conversations around the auditorium as well as wellness coming as we come out of the pandemic. Conversation. We had academic distinctions, as I know that's a conversation that's been going on. Continued sustainability, and then wage and increases for FY23. As I know that's been a conversation from many folks from the employee assembly side, as well as the graduate professional students, have had some conversations around wages and increases for the graduate students. So I wanted to make sure I gave those four bullet points that were provided in advance. And now I'll turn it to you, Duncan, for a question.
Can you repeat the first one of those?
The first one was wellness facilities and programs as it pertains to schools and the auditorium, as well as wellness as we come out of the pandemic.
Awesome. Thank you. Deborah, I'm sorry. I meant to say this in the committee that I couldn't go to, but I can skip the conversation of it Thursday. I'm more than happy to bring that in front of the student assembly. Just reading over the draft, it looks fantastic.
It's coming along. It's coming along, yes.
Yeah. So just wanted to share that. So
big shout out to Kyle from the GTSA for starting the draft and giving us something great to work with.
Thank you. Any other questions for Deborah? Thank you very much, Deborah. We'll turn now to Ian on the Campus Committee on Infrastructure, Technology, and the Environment.
Thank you, Brandon. So last week, the site committee had a meeting to address principally some of the questions and concerns that arose from the discussion of UA Resolution Number 3 introduced in November, which is the smart waste and recycling proposal. The TLDR version is it involves procurement of a number of smart waste receptacles to update the campus trash infrastructure. During the meeting, which was facilitated principally by myself and Sarah Berlinski, the Assistant Director of the Campus Sustainability Office, we had a number of presenters from R5 operations on campus who are principally concerned with the waste management and recycling infrastructure. Those presenters included Spring Bruck, who is the Associate Director of Facilities Management, Dan Scheid, who is the Director of Cornell Grounds, and Christopher Mott, who is in charge of purchasing. There's also a presentation from Beyond Waste, which is an environmental group active on campus, by Kimberly Anderson, who is the Campus Sustainability Office Engagement Manager, as well as Emma Goldenthal, who is a student in the College of Arts and Sciences and a leader within the Beyond Waste organization. Lastly, there was also a presentation from Ethan McElwin, who is a representative from the Big Belly Smart Waste and Recycling Corporation, which is one of the vendors that was contemplated in UA Resolution Number 3. So I'll give you broad strokes, and because I have a lot of information to kind of convey, this will be, I think, best if it's a little bit more collaborative. So if anybody wants to jump in while I'm talking, please feel free to. And we can hopefully get a little back and forth going. So the broad stance of the Campus Sustainability Office is that at this time they are not in favor of the proposal contemplated by UA Resolution Number 3 because it runs counter to their broad strategy for campus waste reduction, which is to try to decrease overall waste by making it slightly more difficult to dispose of it. The idea is that if a person has to take an extra step, maybe walking a little farther, opening a bin, that, you know, goes into the broader context of maybe I should not bring this non-disposable item with me to campus, or the disposable, non-reusable item with me to campus. However, after listening to points raised by the presenters.
Question is, how reasonable do you think that expectation is?
Well,
that's a question for sustainability, I might add.
Well, what I'll say is, while I support the goals of reducing campus waste, by, you know, the title of my committee requires me to also think of the infrastructure component as well as the technology component. So there's something to be said for achieving that medium. And while, you know, climate change is going to be a challenge that everybody has to deal with, I don't necessarily think that the Campus Sustainability Office's goal is as, I don't want to say it's not realistic, but there will always be waste that people need to dispose of. And I think it's possible to actually address some of the goals that they have, you know, and achieve a happy medium while also still making it possible for people to dispose of their waste and to update the way that they do it. So, you know, and the reason I say that is because some of the points that were raised by Springbuck and Dan Schein during the discussion actually are supported by the goal that the smart waste management system supports. You know, for instance, they raised the issue of, you know, their concerns are fuel costs expended by picking up empty bags when bins aren't full. And as they pointed out, the reason that they have to do this is because if waste is left in these bins for too long, animals get at it. Well, the smart waste receptacle system solves that problem by both preventing animals from getting into the bins because they're pretty heavy, but also alerting them when they need to be picked up. So you're not burning fuel, just making rounds.
Yeah, I just want to back up again. The behavioral expectation that a shortage of waste disposal sites would encourage people not to bring waste to campus. That's one part of your question. Does that behavioral expectation seem reasonable to you? The second one is, do we actually know how much waste is brought to campus as opposed to generated on campus? I would think there's not that much coming off campus by individuals.
Well, I think it's reasonable.
But that's just me. I mean, these expectations seem weak.
I think it's reasonable to try to reduce the amount of non-reusable waste that students, faculty, employees, you know, and staff dispose of on campus. I don't think it's reasonable to eliminate it completely. So, you know, two examples I'll give that are concerns raised by campus sustainability are Amazon packages in the residence halls and Starbucks cups. You're not going to get rid of Amazon packages. Students are going to still order things from Amazon. the disposable cups. I mean, you can reduce them because I think it's beneficial to encourage people to bring reusable cups with them to Starbucks. But there will always be people who don't have those reusable cups. And I don't necessarily think it's reasonable to tell them that they can't get a coffee if they want one. There are also a lot of other initiatives that, you know, Cornell has taken, some of which Brandon highlighted with dining. We're back to no longer having the non-reusable containers, right?
We have thank you, Richard, for the question. Just acknowledging Richard is asking the questions to help Casey down the road there. But the reusable containers have been in use in dining. We went to the takeout containers due to the pandemic for a period of time, and these first 2 weeks we saw a massive amount of disposable containers fill the garbage cans all across residence halls. We're very happy to have eliminated this recyclable or disposable container. And now to get food in our dining halls to leave, you must have a reusable container. We provide one free to every student, one available to every student that they can use for reusable containers. It's easy. You drop it at the door, you get a fresh new one that's cleaned and ready for you, and you take your food out. Come back next time, you exchange that dirty one for a clean one again. So that has been changed. If I may, I just wanted to acknowledge some of the comments around that. There are strategies from my perspective sounded around some concerns of how consumers act and behave, and that consumers are actually a bigger part of the problem than the waste in many scenarios. And so I think there's opportunity from what we heard from the Big Belly, that they have this really high-end, super expensive container that addresses some problems we don't have, but they have a very simplistic idea of that handle that comes down and that keeps animals out and makes it more connected to what I'm disposing of in that facility. So I may recommend we look at some of the alternative options that may have a reduced cost, because these units are quite pricey to think about, because they were really looking at how can we get the recyclable materials to be actually recyclable. And they found that typically, and I see this in dining halls, front-end consumer compostables are garbage. Like literally they go in the trash 95% of the time, front-end compostable items. That's just an estimation. That's an actual statistic from Cornell Dining. I'm not representing that. But I'm just giving you an anecdotal perspective that the vast majority of items that are front-end consumer compostable and recyclable containers are most often commingled with garbage and very difficult to be actually used. So that's one of the challenges that they've been looking for. So I saw Jacob and Nelson had some questions.
I kind of wanted just to speak very frankly about the meeting that we had, and I think that Ian touched on a lot of good points, and he touched on something that was really, you know, I knew. Do you want to finish before I continue? Or?
I mean, let's just keep it going. All right, I can talk the next 30 minutes.
Right. Yeah. So there was a lot of really interesting insight that we got into the sustainability office and their agenda here, and it seems as though, you know, as an environmental policy student, you learn about consumer incentives and incentives in propagating more environmentally sustainable behavior, and it just seems like this is not one of them. I mean, they had cited statistics that said that the majority of the data, the garbage that's collected is collected inside. Well, of course it is, because the majority of the garbage cans are inside. So if you want to throw something away, you got to go inside and throw it away. The way it stands currently, the garbage system has not been even thought about, it seems, in quite some time. I mean, the last time that there was any sort of overhaul in the way that the current system works with our current garbage can systems, our current garbage can replacement and the collection process, was easily years ago. I mean, they had cited often through pictures folks who were working on the proposal through the student assembly. And I served on the student assembly. I was there as a freshman. It was 24. I mean, it was long before any of us were involved. So it's been quite some time. And I was also perplexed to hear that a lot of the garbage cans had actually been moved from their original spots. So now they're scattered all over campus in places that they don't really even belong. They're not in the most efficient spots to collect the garbage. And I really fear, you know, as Ian said, nobody's going to stop ordering Amazon. And as a matter of fact, we're actually moving towards a much more difficult path forward, where instead of figuring out how we're going to get rid of an apple, we're now starting to move towards technological recycling and how we're disposing of technological waste. And that's actually becoming quite a big issue that I was reading about recently, specifically here at Cornell, with regard to printer cartridges and toner and the way that we get rid of that sort of thing. Because, you know, you go to Staples and buy a toner and it comes with the shipping, the recycling, but for like a big system that's working to pumping out thousands of copies of a certain document, I mean, we're dealing with some serious high-powered equipment that, you know, it's difficult to get rid of. In the end, though, they, you know, R5, the sustainability folks, hit on every single point as to why it seemed like we needed the amendments that we were proposing to a smart, recyclable infrastructure system, whatever you want to call it. I mean, yeah, there were examples of folks from the facilities department going to collect garbage, and there was one wrapper, one cup in there with an entire bag, and they were wasting all the gas, resources, time, collecting that one bag with one garbage. I mean, they even admitted, the sustainability office, that they were creating more waste just by going to get that one bag than they were otherwise. And so the folks at Buildability had shown us data from other schools in a very similar environment, notably Lehigh University, kind of that suburban feel. And they showed that out of all the garbage cans that they had, that they had quite a few big buildings, only a few of them were actually ready to be picked up. So it saves money in terms of fuel, in terms of labor. It saves time. It certainly saves resources. We can have those folks who are collecting garbage working on some other initiative in the maintenance field. And of course, it's much more environmentally friendly. The other thing that I think is key, as you know, some folks know, I'm a huge proponent of this living laboratory theory. That Cornell ought to serve as a laboratory to benefit. You know, we ought to collect data here on campus through these the implementation of a lot of our strategies in order to help benefit the rest of society. And this is certainly one of them. I mean, the Big Belly also collects tons of data on waste management and the way that consumers act and what we choose to recycle. So those are just a few things. Very passionate about it. So that was not organized at all. But if you have any questions. And Ian, I'm sorry for usurping.
No, you did great. In response to a couple points. So right now, because the existing trash cans have been around since 2014, and if you've seen them, they're smaller, a little more lightweight. One of the points that Brown's made is that a lot of them have been moved, and they're currently is not a ground truth map of where all the outdoor receptacles are. You know, and this point came up during the meeting because one of the proposed initiatives for Beyond Waste this spring is actually a mapping project to find out where all the trash receptacles are. So this speaks to a broader issue with just the need to update the waste management infrastructure outdoors. And some bins can actually be probably eliminated in areas where there is not a high amount of foot traffic. You know, because it's also about optimizing the placement of bins based on a data-driven approach to be the most efficient and get the most, you know, bang for their buck. You know, in addition to what was, you know, discussed at the meeting, and the recording is actually available, by the way, if anybody wants to view it. It's currently in the site folder in the university assembly box. You know, I also had some interesting points made by Brandon about the cost effectiveness in regards to the issue being addressed, and that, you know, some of the high cost purchases might not necessarily be addressing the issue that Brown felt. So, you know, in response to that, and, you know, if I say anything that doesn't represent your point, please let me know. Even though Grounds and the Sustainability Office initially took the position that they're opposed to this, they also raised concerns that are addressed by this, specifically fuel cost, animals, and bins being moved. So, as the cost piece, although there is a high, you know, upfront capital cost, corresponding to that is the cost reduction that comes through reduced fuel and labor saving, because right now, you know, Cornell does have a bit of a labor shortage, It's difficult to want to find employees to do some jobs. And by redirecting labor that would otherwise be making rounds to clear bins to another task, you know, that is a way of addressing that. You know, as to the cost-effective piece, there are several pricing options because the Big Belly does offer both a purchase option, which is in the $3,000 to $6,000 per unit range, depending on how you optimize it. But there is also a monthly lease cost, which runs about $138 a month. After the bins are purchased, the capital cost is minimal. Occasionally, they'll need a sensor cleaning or a battery replacement. That typically runs in once every several years. That is a service that can also be provided by Big Belly. A couple of ancillary points as well. This has kind of become the standard at other Ivy League and peer institutions. Other Ivy League students that have installed them include Harvard, Yale, Brown, Princeton, and Columbia. They're also present on Vanderbilt's campus, as well as a large number of large state universities such as Florida. Ithaca Commons also uses Big Bellies. Cornell adopted a system as well. It would be us following the lead of the Ithaca community and creating greater synergy between us and them. So at the end of the day, you know, despite the concerns raised by campus sustainability, I'm still in favor of the resolution because I think it addresses a lot of the issues that have been articulated. Even if at the top level, it doesn't directly run in alignment with the campus sustainability office strategy for waste reduction.
Thank you, Ian and Jacob, what you just added there. I think also I kind of just want to circle back on a couple of things from our previous conversations about Big Belly, as well as kind of addressing, I think, like broader concepts with this around sustainability and our role in just trying to support a better campus. First, I just wanted to address something that you mentioned. Tom, if you remember last meeting, we talked about the batteries, the issue with the solar panel. The Big Belly can go about a month and a half without a charge. So even in the worst snowstorm, even without a single member of the Cornell community being good Samaritan and just kind of brushing it off.
I'm not arguing with you, but I will point out that we have had 6 inches of snow on every surface for the last 6 weeks.
I'm really happy you mentioned that. They actually have Big Bellies in the Arctic Circle right now in Scandinavian countries where they have a lot more than 6 inches and they get it a lot more than once a month.
Okay.
So, you know, our fear of we're not in Florida, we're not in Arizona is likely pretty met. Because Lehigh, one of our neighbors, a relatively similar size peer institution with snow just like us, is, you know, going through it. Similarly, you know, we've opened the door to conversations about funding. I think there's a broader conversation with that when you consider what are the limited resources sustainability at Cornell is operating on and their fear of kind of having lofty goals but not always having the ambition, the funds to meet it. So I'd be more than happy to like look into that and trying to get more of their support with this project personally. As well as I kind of also wanted to mention too, I think we're looking at an issue right now of there's a lot of people in Cornell who are feeling affected by this. They're feeling, you know, they're walking around with trash. They're feeling there's nowhere to throw it. They're seeing, you know, litter all around our campus because, you know, the trash builds up in West Campus, trash builds up in North Campus, and it flows to the slope. It finds its way on different plazas, different main roads. You know, we're going by Hope Plaza. We're seeing two trash cans. If any of you go there, seriously, I'm telling you, look at it. It's stuffed to the brim, right? And right now we're sitting in front of an opportunity to fix problems, sustainability, and facilities brought up. We're looking at an opportunity to help a lot of students, a lot of faculty, a lot of staff, a lot of just members of our community, help beautify our campus, help kind of make it a world-renowned institution in its looks that we try and emulate in our classrooms, interactions. And we just have a chance to meet peer institutes for, I think, a relatively good price in building a better for the environment campus and a better learning environment in general. And I think a lot of the work by the site committee, a lot of the work by Jake Ian, and I can't take too much credit for it, but just getting to see this holistically is pointing in the direction that we're fixing a lot of problems we have, and we're helping the community while we do it. And, you know, I hope we can talk about it more, but I'm really excited about, you know, possibly moving forward with this.
Yes, I won't reiterate anything that's already been said, but I did want to say I was grateful that Ian opened up the site meeting to anyone, and a little bit disappointed that so few people showed up. But it was a really fascinating presentation, and I thought, in the end, I thought, well, can't you do both? For example, I think it was Springbok who talked about their focus for staff is on, their focus for everyone is on what are the things we have a choice about, and particularly with staff, they were looking at coffee cups. And so why couldn't we work with them to support that initiative and at the same time do a resolution concerning the Big Belly style trash containers? So I appreciated it. I thought it was really useful to hear both sides, and thanks for taking it on.
Anything else, Ian?
That's all I have.
Well, thank you for the continued conversation around this resolution, for the continued work there, and seeing that brought back here to the floor. For those who recall, it was sent to the committee to continue that work, and then to eventually come back here to the assembly for a vote on that. And I would echo the sentiment. There are many initiatives that we can continue to work on from a sustainability perspective as the assembly to advocate for other changes in the university to help make a positive impact. I agree that many challenges when it comes to garbage, you look in many places, you see large cans across campus, stuff flying out of them, some big challenges with the R5 team. I do want to say that I really appreciated the acknowledgement of R5 that the grounds team and the facilities team and the sustainability team are a singular unit operation, not fighting against each other, but working together. So I know that there is a goal and to bring those ideas together. That it's not just about garbage and sustainability, that they all they coincide with one another. So I'm really happy to hear that perspective as well. Thank you for your continued work on that.
Can I just ask a quick question? You mentioned that the presentation was on a video that's accessible off the UA site for the site committee?
It's in the site committee box folder.
Oh, in the box folder. Great. Okay.
I'm going to send that to the assembly website or email. We can make sure that it gets up. We'll highlight it on the website.
It's I think it's a little too large email, but I think it's over a gigabyte in size because it was a fairly long meeting. But I can send
you use the Dropbox, Cornell Dropbox or something.
Right here, but the video of the meeting.
We're recording the meeting.
Oh, I see. We should have that.
Video lifted off the box.
Yeah, we should be able to get that probably from the video on demand. It was a Zoom meeting.
We had to switch from the video on demand link we normally use at the last minute because the speaker from Big Belly was unable to join the meeting since I believe it was only limited to Cornell email addresses.
Oh.
So we had to swap to a different meeting link at the last second.
Oh,
so
I can follow
up with
my name. We'll see if we can find a way to make that accessible.
All right. With that, are there any liaison reports that folks I want to give? We have about 5 minutes left here. Not that I would entertain a motion to adjourn or any open discussion.
Sure.
A motion to adjourn. Do we have a second? Any objections? Seeing none, meeting is adjourned. Thank you all, and we will. We've got a clock, and we've got food, and I forgot my gavel.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.